Hello and welcome. This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics, and fashion. I'm Daphne Karnizes. Coming up today?
That was one of his trademarks and one of the things that made his gardens so modern, that they challenged the traditional order of the European formal garden.
We delve into the world of landscape architecture and visit an exhibition at New York's Botanical Garden on the work of legendary Brazilian landscape designer, the late Roberto Burle Marx. And?
Technology, when it is designed right, and we give people superpowers, that you feel that way. And you don't feel like you're, oh my God, I'm dealing with technology.
We meet Tony Fadell, one of the people credited with inventing the iPod and iPhone at the annual Science and Arts Festival, Starmus. Plus, for the second part of our Big Insight series, we speak to the president of the American-headquartered architectural firm Cohn Pedersen Fox about his priorities, hopes, and preoccupations at the top. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. From now until the 29th of September, the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx is transforming into a tropical Brazilian paradise. The organization's largest botanical exhibition to date shines a spotlight on the living art of celebrated Brazilian modernist Roberto Burle Marx, a painter, sculptor, landscaper, and plant lover whose creativity seemingly knows no bounds. The exhibition features an outdoor garden of lush vegetation inspired by Burle Marx, who died in 1994, as well as further plant explorations in one of the conservatories. Over in the library building, you can also glimpse his fine art that spanned painting, drawing, and textiles. We sent our America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, to immerse himself in the foliage.
I'm sitting on a train here at Grand Central Station, about to depart. My destination is the Bronx, and it's going to take me about 20 minutes or so to get up there. But much more than a transportation from Manhattan to an outer borough. In fact, I'm expecting to almost be teleported to a Brazil of tropical opulence and modernist might.
My name is Victoria Lewis. I'm the manager of interpretive content at the New York Botanical Garden. The Living exhibition was designed by Miami-based landscape architect Raymond Jungles, who was a friend and protege of Roberto Burle Marx in the last decade or so of Burle Marx's life. They met when Raymond Jungles was a landscape design student in Miami, and he wound up going to Brazil to see Burle Marx many times. So he created this garden for us in the style of Roberto Burle Marx. It's sort of an imaginary Burle Marx garden. It doesn't exactly replicate any one garden, but instead borrows elements from a number of his creations to create something that really encapsulates his style. The biomorphic pathways through the garden are very typical Roberto Burle Marx. That was one of his trademarks and one of the things that made his gardens so modern, that they challenged the traditional order of the European formal garden. The pavement is patterned black and white in this undulating pattern, which is reminiscent but doesn't duplicate the boardwalk at Copacabana Beach in Rio de Janeiro. That was a style that Burle Marx applied in a few of his different creations, including Biscayne Boulevard in downtown Miami. And that was his take on the traditional Portuguese art form called Pedras Portuguesas.
Maybe you can just tell listeners a little bit more about Burle Marx, because he seemed to do quite a lot in his lifetime, as in he wasn't just a landscaper. He also was a sculptor, an artist, a plant lover, a preservationist. Maybe just give us an idea of the influence he left behind as a Brazilian modernist pioneer.
Roberto Burle Marx was born in 1909 in Sao Paulo. He grew up in Rio de Janeiro. And he always wanted to be an artist. He went to art school and was trained as a painter. But later he discovered, as a young man in his early 20s, he discovered his great love of plants, and specifically of Brazilian plants. And that inspired him to change course and go into landscape design. But he never abandoned painting. He painted throughout his life, and he was just endlessly creative. It's cliche, but he would be called a Renaissance man. He painted, he created sculptures. He designed jewelry with one of his brothers. He designed t-shirts and lamps and tablecloths. He never stopped creating. He was also a musician. He trained as an opera singer, and he threw these amazing parties where he would create all of the decorations. He would paint a new tablecloth for every party, and at the end of the party, he would sing. And he would sing Brazilian songs and also the classical music that he'd been trained trained in, which was all part of his general philosophy of combining influences, combining the old European and colonial influences in Brazil with the local culture.
And he also left quite a mark on Brasilia as well. Maybe you can tell us about how he sort of helped forge the new capital.
When the new capital was established in Brasilia in the 1960s, Roberto Burle Marx was the main landscape architect for the entire planned city. He was very intimately involved with modernists of all shapes and stripes, including modernist architects like Corbusier, Oscar Niemeyer, Lúcio Costa. And Lúcio Costa and Oscar Niemeyer together designed most of Brasilia in concert with Burle Marx's landscapes.
What did he want to achieve through his landscapes, through his sculptures? What was his philosophy of design?
Burle Marx's philosophy evolved as he matured as an artist. But ultimately, I think it all comes down to his love of nature, and particularly his love of his native country and the nature there. He was the first to incorporate Brazilian native plants into landscape designs. At the time, when he was coming up in the 30s and 40s, no one wanted wild plants. The jungle was undesirable. It was wild, and people wanted very formal rose gardens.
So they looked more to Europe before.
Burle Marx created something new entirely. And later he grew to incorporate tropical plants from elsewhere in the world. But he always was a real champion for the native plants of Brazil. And in using them in his landscapes, he hoped to teach people about them and help them to learn how important it was to conserve the native landscape, which was rapidly being destroyed.
Well, we're standing in this amazing garden in the shade on a rather hot summer's day. Maybe you can point out some of the plants.
As this multi-talented artist, he conceived of gardens not just as something ornamental, but really an immersive experience that would touch on all of your senses. So that is the philosophy that Raymond Jungles applied for this garden. And among all these palm trees, which almost never grow outside in our climate, we brought them all up just for this, and they'll just last for the summer. We have these amazing towering palm trees. We have a Burmese fishtail palm, which is right over here.
Amazing. Yeah.
We have queen palms, which are these really tall ones. Now, not all of these are native to Brazil, but many of them are plants that he worked with. Actually, at his home in the Sitio, he had one of the largest collections of tropical plants anywhere in the world. And he combined plants in interesting ways that you wouldn't find in nature. So we have plants that are from Brazil. We have plants that you might even think of as a typical American garden plant. We had to adapt a bit, but actually he did use coleus, just like North American gardeners. These bromeliads are one of his very favorite bromeliads. This one here, which is called Ichmea blanchettiana. It's lime green, but if it's out in the sun and gets enough sun, it turns bright orange, like deep red.
We have to turn and look at this amazing central piece, really, this sculpture, very modernist looking, that has a waterfall feature, water pouring out the front. Maybe you can explain that.
The water feature that this whole winding path is leading us to is based very closely on a sculptural wall that Burle Marx created for the lobby of the headquarters of the Banco Safra. Now, this wall that he created inside the lobby, it's a concrete structure. It isn't a water feature, but we adapted it and made it into a water feature. So we're sort of combining a few different elements of his work. He often created sculptural walls in his gardens, often used mosaics, and he loved water features.
Walking on.
Heading into this beautiful conservatory where the exhibition continues. You may be able to hear Brazilian music in the background and just an array of tropical plants surrounding me. Now, one of the most interesting things is the fact that he was a botanist, and many of the plants here, well, around 20 of them or so, are named after him because he discovered them. Tell me, why did you decide to put on a show, an exhibition of Burle Marx? Do you think he'd received enough attention here in the US?
Burle Marx is a national hero in Brazil. Every kid grows up, I think, knowing who he is, but he is woefully little known in the United States. He actually was at a time somewhat famous in the States. He was featured in a show at MoMA in the 40s. And he did a lot of work here. In recent years, there was a nice show of some of his artwork at the Jewish Museum, but this is the first time that anyone has made a really large-scale tribute to all of his artwork, his landscape as well as his fine art. So you can experience a landscape in his style, and then you can go into our art gallery and see his paintings. And they relate to one another, but they're not synonymous.
Eu sou o samba.
Thanks to Ed Stocker there in New York. And Brazilian Modern, the art of Roberta Burley Marx, is on until the 29th of September at New York's Botanical Garden. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the arts and science festival Starmus brought together in Zurich the who's who of the astronomy world, as well as legendary musicians. Monocle's Andrew Müller sat down with Tony Fidel, principal of investment company Future Shape, and one of the people credited with inventing the iPod and iPhone. Andrew started by asking him how important it is to get people to regard science and technology with the same kind of wonder in which they regard art and music.
I think the great thing is that the technology, when it is designed right, and we give people superpowers, that you feel that way. And you don't feel like you're, oh my God, I'm dealing with technology, right? It's like a friction. Like, oh, I don't want to use that computer. If you remember the 80s, you know, that's when I was growing up. Like, you hated using them unless you're really geeked out on it. Today, you know, if you do technology right, it feels seamless and like it is a superpower. So, no, that's not a bad thing that we take it for granted. But I do think that people like to learn about things. They just have different ways of learning about them. Some people love to read research papers. Other people want to see visuals. Other people want to hear music, right? And maybe the technology that goes into creating music. There's different entry points. And you have to give them all these different entry points. And then their curiosity will then lead to questions. If you just want to say, how does this semiconductor component work? It's a very different question than saying, hey, you know that thing inside your cell phone that allows you to figure out where you are in the world? You want to know how that works? They go, like, yeah, I want to know. How does that camera in my cell phone work, right? That I take selfies every day. You know, some people actually want to know that. Where does my data go to? So you have to start with a point of entry that's usually something that works with that person, and it's individual, right? Just like we want to change our education in the schools to not just be sitting down and reading textbooks and taking tests. Each kid learns in a different way. We need to do that the same way for not just kids, but for everybody in the world to help get more curious and to make science more accessible to them.
Well, possibly, and indeed hopefully, a better framing of that same question is, it strikes me that if there's an overlap between, say, the space programs, especially the Apollo program, and the smartphone technology that you worked on, is that surrounding both of them, there was this idea that they would be catalysts of a kind of a uniting of humanity, this amazing connective, collective enterprise that we are working on. Now, the Apollo programs, I think it's fair to say, failed to unite the planet as one entirely happy, at-ease brotherhood. Is there any frustration on your part with what people have done with smartphone technology, that in many respects it seems to have made us more insular, self-obsessed, and possibly, certainly if you look at a lot of social media, actually more argumentative and rancorous than we previously were?
You know, as we know, technology can be both used for good and bad purposes, right? And so technology is neutral. And so I look at this all the time as, oh my God, what tool did we bring in the iPhone to the world and smartphones in general? And I think we've done a tremendous amount of good. When I go around to developing countries and to Southeast Asia or India, and I see the power at everyone who has it, regardless of how much money they make or what socioeconomic status they're in, they have this power and they see the information they need to actually get them into a better place in life, whatever that is. That is incredibly powerful. Of course there's going to be drawbacks, and we always have to fight against them. And I think the technology leaders that are in place today have to fight against that. You know, we absolutely need to say what we think is right, not just say it's an open platform for anybody, anywhere, to do whatever they want. Free speech, you know, it should be allowed. I don't believe that. I remember a very, very vivid conversation we had when doing the iTunes music store with Steve and video store. And Steve Jobs, that is. And so when it was coming out, people were saying, well, what kind of content should we allow on that store? Right? There was the difference, you know, there was music and there was explicit and non-explicit music and that stuff. So we went by that. But then we also said, well, what kind of videos? And Steve was like, well, what do you say? Well, people are saying, well, should we have pornography on that? Should we have all kinds of hate videos, these kinds of things? And he was like, do you want to grow up in a, your kid to grow up in a world like that? Is that what we want to actually sell? Is that what we want to offer our customers? We need to be the arbiters of what we think is the right thing culturally and morally and ethically. And we need to make those judgment calls. Because at the end of the day, this is going to be our kids using this. Mm. And their kids using it, our grandkids using it. So what are we going to say is the right thing to do for our society and our communities and our families? And so if you look at it, and what's really interesting to me is the companies that grew up with founders who weren't married versus the founders who were married. And if you look
That's
at Steve Jobs had a family and kids, and he understood what design meant to the family. And if you think about, you know, Google and YouTube and Facebook, they were all single. They didn't have kids. And when you have kids, your worldview changes very, very much. Dramatically.
That's really interesting, and I had not thought of that, because the next question I was about to ask you was how much of the philosophy underpinning certainly that libertarian ethos of the online realm came from the fact that whether they were with people who had families or not, most of what we understand as big technology has been driven by Americans, who do, of course, have this near religious belief in the First Amendment, and have, are maybe now learning over the last few decades that it may not be quite as necessarily universally applicable as they might have thought?
Well, I think that there is the First Amendment for sure, which is freedom of speech. Mm. But it doesn't mean you have the freedom of speech on my platform. It doesn't, you can go talk somewhere else. You can say it wherever you'd like. See, but you don't have to necessarily do it on my platform, and I'm not going to allow it. We have to go back to first principles and look at the designs of these platforms or these spaces, these social spaces, and then say, what are the rules we really want? And so there's a great company out there that I luckily got to be involved in. It's called Vero, V-E-R-O. Mm. And that's exactly a safe space, a shared space, where it has used first design principles to create a social media experience that's around that. And if people are acting up in a way that is not just in some social norm, but really, really acting, they get kicked off right away. It's like, bye, we don't need you. Go down, go back to Facebook if you'd like.
Well, to bring that thought seamlessly back to this community that we're in right here, right now at Starmus, how do you see it expanding? And I guess, is there something about expansion that Starmus you think might be wise to be wary of? If it got too big, would it lose part of what currently makes it special? If this sort of turned into some vast, sprawling Glastonbury Festival-sized event?
You know, I would love to have that problem, to deal with that problem when it gets there. I think what we want to do is inspire more people, get more people a part of it and understand what this is about and inspire this generation, the next generations, because Starmus is going to be helpful, incredibly helpful for the climate crisis we're with under right now, right? And we're going to have to get ourselves out of it, and we're going to have to take the space technology that we have created and point it back at the Earth to help us watch the Earth, to watch over it. And just like we hear about that overview experience, you know, when you're looking back at the globe, we need everyone to look back at the globe and say, it's just us. It isn't that fence in my backyard. It isn't that, you know, that water border or whatever it is. It is literally all of us. And we're going to all be on this together, or we're going to all, like, more or less die together.
Okay, just one very final and extremely self-interested question, then, and I know this is probably not your department anymore, but you might know the person whose department it is. Is there any chance at all of the iPod Classic getting another run? Because I don't know how much longer I can keep mine alive.
That is a very interesting question. I keep pondering that all the time. You know, you go back to those certain things, and you wish they still existed. Luckily, there's eBay. And other places, but I understand what you want. And I hope one day someone will bring that back to life.
That was Tony Fadell talking to Andrew Müller at the Starmus Festival in Zurich. And for more reports from that festival, be sure to tune into Monocle's brand new podcast, A Giant Leap, in association with Kaspersky, available at monocle.com. Now, architects were once given a specific brief to fulfill, along with a budget in which to do it. But as the pressures they face change and multiply, their remit is expanding too, to include the spaces in between buildings and how our city buildings gel together. In part two of our Big Insight series, I'm joined by James von Klemperer, who has been president and design principal at Cohn Pedersen Fox Associates for nearly 40 years. His work ranges in scale from a house to a city, and he leads a staff of over 600 people in 9 offices around the world. So let me just start by asking you about the role of architects. You know, it used to be that architects were given a brief and a specific budget to fulfill that. Do you think that things are changing, and do you think that they should be given a broader remit?
Yeah, I think the kind of architecture that we practice, which is fairly large scale, usually pretty intense in the positions within the middle of cities where our projects find themselves, are subject to a lot of reinterpretation of what a building type is. And that comes along also in a time and an age of more sharing of program, sharing of uses. Office building lobby is meant to be more like a hotel. Office use is more sort of fungible. People are moving back and forth. And in the places in particular in, I would say, in London, in New York, in Hong Kong, and Shanghai, where we make maybe 70% of our work, there are such things as mixed-use projects that don't really have a brief when you begin. The brief, the use, the understanding of how people are going to flow through buildings is the design, along with physical structure and the base systems and the materials and the rooms and so on. But understanding the menu of what one adds together to make an urban experience is the challenge, is the fun, and should be the value that's brought to the place.
Do you think that in a way it's also the architect's responsibility to not build? How important is it to be restoring and reusing the buildings that we already have?
Yeah, so that should be rule number one, in a way, a kind of architect's Hippocratic oath, not to destroy before embarking on a project, not to assume that one has to take down. Now, those are some quite tricky equations because, again, in these sort of high-value urban centers near public transport, near the densest parts of cities, there are cases where an older building, let's say if you're in Midtown Manhattan next to Grand Central Station, and there might be a 20-story building with outmoded ceiling heights, old mechanical systems, leaky walls, an architecture that's uninspiring. It's both functionally, aesthetically, but also probably environmentally not a good idea to assume that building needs to be there forever. So there's a certain tipping point. One might look for a kind of aggregate value of the building, not just a real estate value, but a value that has to do with externalities, with an environmental output. So following that example, in Midtown New York, there's a program of rezoning the center of the city to try to encourage the destruction of some of those special cases of clunker buildings that should come down to replace with something smarter. So it's a little bit like asking, should you keep a car from the 1970s that's belching out of its tailpipes? And what about all the embedded energy in the new car where that might replace it, but that might offset the life cycle function of the car, the older car as it continues. So these are considerations that we as architects make and should make, and that owners sometimes make and sometimes need encouragement from city regulators or federal, in the case of the United States, government bodies to think about.
And what about technology and things like smart technology? How do you leverage that, I guess, and use those tools, but I guess at the same time continue to pay importance to things like tactility in the space?
Well, I'm not a Luddite, and technology is something we all benefit from. But I think the way in which technology changes architecture is sometimes misinterpreted or not that well understood. For a while, there was, and maybe I can put it in the past tense, an idea of building a smart city. So we engaged in a project for a new city, ground up, a few 100,000 people in Korea, started 20 years ago.
What's it called?
New Songdo City. And at the time, the iPhone, the Android, the smartphone didn't exist. And so the technologies that could bring more ubiquitous use of of things, the placeless application of our knowledge of where things are, that we don't see them by sight, but we, of course, can navigate electronically, didn't exist. So we made a smart city, which was, I think, for its time, extraordinary. 5 years later, it was something very, very commonplace, because technology has already sort of made possible what architects and developers and planners thought was going to be really outlandish in an exciting way.
I mean, I guess you've kind of answered this, but I was going to ask what the biggest priorities for you as a firm are in 2019. I know you touched on a few things, but how would you summarize that?
I think our priorities are not so swayed by short-term trends, to my point of the long-term meaning and value and importance of buildings and cities. But there are certainly some trends that are advancing in this kind of inexorable way. And one of them is the issue of carbon footprint and climate change that is really facing the whole profession, not particular to one firm or one community of architects. It has to be a global concern. So one might generalize about a certain set of externalities, of issues that are outside of the actual building use and have more to do with the effect of a building on its broader environment, or its broader place. That does include the carbon footprint. So I think there is now a kind of reorientation. It happens, you know, to the issue of climate change and the issue of carbon footprint. The adjustment to this set of issues is it comes late. Some may say it comes so late that we can't make a difference. It's an asymmetrical adjustment that right now in certain governments is happening almost not in a forward direction, but in a reverse direction. Witness what's happening now at the federal level in the United States. It's the opposite of a leadership that would allow us to deal with this problem. But it's so pervasive an issue. It's our atmosphere. I don't think architects have really faced a challenge as existential as this ever before. I mean, we had buildings which thought about the meaning of the universe, you know, whether it's a Palladian civic building or some great Boulay observatory. You know, we talk about the heavens and about eternal meaning in architecture, but never before have buildings really been directly linked to these issues. One of the ways in which we can respond to some current challenges of overly crowded cities and cities which are responsible for so much energy output is actually further densification. Sounds a bit like a contradiction. But to make the places where we naturally already inhabit, the center with transport, with uses that come together to make a kind of efficient transfer of commerce to living to entertainment, is something that takes a great deal of skill architecturally to almost choreograph the way people use space with physical structures. The more we can make those centers really enjoyable, viable, useful places, the more cities don't have to sprawl, and they allow us to save on transport, save on time. You know, in some ways, the best models for future sustainable environments are the medium-sized and quite compact European cities, where streets are narrow, apartments are smaller, and people live together in a kind of almost organic way, like bees in a hive. And the skill of creating or recreating that kind of setting with a dense urban architecture is something that I think is called for more and more today. And that's one of the missions of our practice.
Thanks to James von Klemperer joining me there. He's the president and design principal at Cohn Pedersen Fox Associates. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, available on newsstands. Monocle on Design was produced by David Stevens. I'm Daphne Karnesis. Bye for now.